In this episode of the Lifestyle.org podcast, we have a very special guest, one of the very first people that went to Afghanistan right after 9/11, a person that the movie 12 Strong was based after. Four Soldiers tells you all about it. An incredible guest. You don't want to miss it today. So hang on. I'm here today with Christopher Spence. Welcome, Christopher. So glad you're here on the podcast.
Roy, thank you for inviting me.
It's so great to have you. Now, you were a master sergeant and you're retired now. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Awesome. Well, you have an incredible story. I want us to dive right into it. Where were you on 9/11 when the planes hit the World Trade Center towers?
That's a great starting point because I think, you know, all of us can capture or remember where we were. It's kind of like when we speak to our parents, every one of them can tell us where they were when John F. Kennedy was shot. It's just one of those moments that everybody knows about. So I was actually at the hospital with my oldest son. He had broken his arm and we were having the pin removed from his arm after it had done its thing and healed. We were having a pulse. We were waiting in the doctor's office, and then someone had walked into the doctor and said, "Hey, a small plane hit the World Trade Center."
Oh my word! Yeah, I was just waking up, you know, getting ready, you know, for work that day, and I just felt really compelled. Turn on the TV, and that's very unlike me. I'm not like a guy that watches the news.
Sure.
I'm getting ready, but I just really felt compelled to turn on the TV. And the moment I turned it on, they were showing footage of World Trade Center, the first one that got hit. So you were in the military at this time?
Yes.
And so what happened? Walk me through, since you were one of the first people to go over to Afghanistan to try to hunt down Al-Qaeda, who was responsible. Walk me through the timeline. What happened from the time of 9/11 and you going over to Afghanistan?
Basically, it was very crazy. Basically, 9/11 happened. The security posture at Fort Campbell went from its daily threatcon level to their highest threatcon level. And getting on post is kind of like driving through LA traffic. It takes forever. And so basically, every car, they reduced all the traffic control points to basically 1 to 2 points where everybody had to go through vehicle checks, inspections, the whole nine yards. So a lot of people were actually just living on post and not even going home because it took so long to get back on post in the morning. So we knew that our unit was going to be called up within the first week, that we're going to be one of the first ones to deploy. So basically everybody began packing all their stuff and we just got ready to receive word to go. And then we actually were chosen to fly out of Fort Campbell, Kentucky, to start the push over to K2 or Karfi Khanabad. And we actually deployed out of Fort Campbell over Columbus Day weekend. Yeah. So roughly 30 days after 9/11, we were gone.
Wow. Now, were you selected because you were part of a special unit?
Yes, we're members of the 5th Special Forces Group, and we were one of the first units to go over there and put up a permanent footprint over in Karfi Khanabad, which was one of the things we were waiting on before we could deploy, was for an agreement to be made between the United States government and Uzbekistan for us to base out of their territory. And once that was agreed upon, that's when we began flying in. All the assets that helped support our mission in Afghanistan started being flown in. So first you have to build a base. So the Air Force was there first, you know, maintain the airfield, bring in their air traffic control folks to fly the planes and bring in all of our stuff in. Then the helicopters were flown in for Task Force 160th, and then the ground troops started getting flown in. It's all a staged act, but it takes a lot of time and movement to bring everything in.
Absolutely. Now, your experience was in some ways documented in two different resources. Of course, the first one, many people have seen the movie 12 Strong, Chris Hemsworth in that movie. I know Hollywood always takes a little bit of liberty just to make sure the plot points are there.
Sure.
But the movie is based off of your experience there. Secondly, there's a book, an incredible book called Horse Soldiers, which I'm sad to say that this morning, I had this on my nightstand. That's not what I'm sad about. What I'm sad about is my oldest son, we're getting ready. He comes into my room, we're talking, and he looks at me and goes, Horse Soldiers? I go, yeah, I'm going to interview this Special Forces guy who was one of the first guys who came into Afghanistan, and they rode these horses. And so it's about the soldiers, not about the horse. And he actually was disappointed because he thought, oh, I thought someone had trained horses to be soldiers, and I really wanted to see a horse shoot a machine gun. And so, yeah, he was a bit disappointed that the horse soldiers were not actually horses.
Not horsing around, I hear.
Exactly. So this book, by the way, is amazing. We will have a link in the description down below, below this video for how you can get this book. But it's an incredible book about Christopher's experience and all the men that were in his unit that were the first in there. But Christopher, I think one of the things that's the coolest in this book is in the middle, you have the section of photographs. Now, these photograph. You were one of the few people that brought a camera.
A digital camera.
Yeah, which is great because phones back in that day, if I recall, were taking 1 to 2 megapixel photos, which makes everything look like Minecraft back in the day.
Yes.
All pixelated. But you actually brought a good camera. In fact, I'm holding here a copy because this is a very famous photo that was held up by Donald Rumsfeld when he was trying to tell us America's response, what America was trying to do in Afghanistan. Talk to me about this photo.
There's really a great backstory to that. So when we landed in Afghanistan, and basically this is, we're about 4 days after my 21st anniversary of going into Afghanistan, because we infilled 3 November.
Wow.
So we infilled, we landed at DZ Burro. We got off the helicopter. Slept on the ground that night next to a cave. Dawson came in the next day. We met him. Well, we also brought in 2 John Deere Gators with us because the transportation problem was so bad. So we drove 2 John Deere Gators off the back of the helicopter that we flew in on. So that day, a gentleman from ODA 595 and I, we then went and did a resupply to some other members of their ODA 595 because they needed water and food and stuff. We brought a bunch of that stuff with us. So we loaded up a gator and we drove off to go do that. And while we were driving, Steve and I stopped because I saw General Dawson and the entourage of soldiers you just held up there riding horseback. I'm like, Steve, stop. We've got to get a picture of this because nobody is going to believe expletive this.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we took the picture, did our thing. We came back. So that night we sent that picture and several others up in our SITREP, which what we're required to do. We always provide a situational report to our higher command every day of what we're doing, what's going on, and what our further intentions are. So the only word we got back was great picture. And that was it. And we didn't hear anything about it again until once our mission was over in Afghanistan and I got back to the United States, then I see that picture's all over the place. I'm like, oh, that's my picture. But underneath it says, courtesy of United States Army. My name was never associated with it.
Yeah. Well, in fact, your name, it's either in the book or the movie.
It is now, yes.
You actually have a code name. And I understand your code name is used quite a bit. Not your real name is used quite a bit in the telling
in the book, of the yes. stories. Yep. Yeah. They use pseudonyms for most of us in the book because it came out while we were still active.
Yeah, that's very smart. So talk to me about this. You become a horse soldier. Had you had any experience before riding horses in any other capacity?
Luckily, yes. Other than at the fair. I grew up in Oregon and our neighbors had horses. So I had ridden them when I was a kid. Our neighbors had some donkeys and some burros, so I had ridden before. So being in and around a horse for me was not bad. The biggest challenge in riding horses in Afghanistan was there was a language barrier.
A language barrier between whom?
You and the horse, because when we were taught to interact with horses. All the John Wayne stuff we learned was whoa, giddy up, things like that. Well, no one taught the horses in Afghanistan English, so all that didn't work. So we had to learn how to all the commands to get the horses to stop and stuff in Afghani.
That's amazing. So instead of saying whoa, what did you have to say?
You said door, door.
Door?
Door, which means stop. And so as long as we knew stop, then, because we had a translator with us, a local was there named, I won't mention the gentleman's name, but he was like, hey, look, I don't need to know anything else. How do I tell it to stop? And he goes, door, door. I'm like, all right, got it.
Wow.
So pull back on the reins and say door.
So were most of the men in your unit comfortable with horses? Any of them, this was kind of
no,
their first
they were
experience?
Not. Yeah, we had one of our STS guys was not a real big horse guy. And he was put on a horse that didn't like to listen because they were all stallions and he didn't like to follow the guy in charge. So his horse would routinely run off and get out of line and run up to the front of the pack. So we're like, look, just steer it, pull the reins towards the uphill. That'll wear him out and it'll get back in line. And then we had a saddle break. A guy fell off. It was quite the experience.
Wow. Now you're in Afghanistan, not only language barriers, not only cultural barriers, but now you have transportation barriers.
Barriers, yep.
You're on horses. This is not something that you go through in boot camp that I've heard of. And so
they did during World War II.
Yeah, it's been a while since then. You have an objective. What is your objective?
Our objective was to link up with the leadership of the Northern Alliance and provide to advise and assist their efforts and introduce American air power and tactics and everything else into their battle plan to assist them. Because General Dostum knew that, look, we have to put an Afghan face on this to remove the Taliban and the Al-Qaeda elements in their area. And Dostum also understood if any Americans are killed, he was worried that Americans would lose the purpose on while we were there, kind of like what happened in Vietnam, where the war drug on and on. So he told us, look, I'd rather see 100 of my men killed than any of yours injured, so we don't lose that the teaming agreement that we have.
Wow. So you head up north, I'm assuming. What was that journey like? What did you experience that was unexpected or some obstacles that you had to overcome?
Well, when we landed in Afghanistan, we were first living in the cave like the movie depicts, but that cave they depicted in the movie looked like the Hilton. We were more like a Motel 6 cave.
but nobody left the light on for you.
There were no lights. basically, some of the weirder aspects of being in Afghanistan, it's so deadly quiet because there's no ambient noise. We live in a world of noise. Yeah. Vehicles, planes flying overhead. There was none of that. You were in like dead quiet. Other than the river valley that we were in, that was basically the only other noise you heard. There were no animals around, nothing.
Wow.
So, and when we first showed up there, I like to everybody for people our age, we've all seen Rocky and Bullwinkle, right? And when you watch Sherman and Mr. Peabody, it was like getting in the Wayback Machine and stepping back into a world that no one really knew about. It was that the technology wasn't there. It was very rural. We would pull up to a village in the middle of nowhere. There's no electricity. There's a village well. There's no cars. There's nothing. It's just mud huts, and they have their sheep and goats that they tend to.
Wow. So you'd roll up on one of these villages. What was the response of the villagers?
No, General Dostum had been in the area for forever, so they were friendly towards us, no problems at all. We'd go, we'd get resupplied there, and then we would roll on to our next. Our objective was to break out of the Darya Suf Valley, get to the gap, breach that gap as depicted in the film. And once that gap was breached, we then drove through that gap and we went in to liberate Mazar-e-Sharif.
Oh, that's amazing. So you mentioned having to live in these caves. Would you just leave your horses outside? What? Because I mean, this is between November and, if I recall, you're there till March. This is the cold season.
It really didn't get that cold yet. It really held off. It started getting really cold once we rolled into Mazar-e Sharif, and once we rolled in, it actually snowed. And the locals said it hadn't snowed there years. So they said this is an omen of good sign that it had snowed because we had liberated Mazar-e Sharif.
Wow, that's incredible.
But so, it wasn't that as cold, but the caves generally are used for the horses. So you can imagine what the cave smelled like. So they would keep the horses in the caves to keep them sheltered and warm.
And you would stay outside the cave?
No, they let us move into the cave, but it was still warm, so the horses were outside. So basically, Dostum and the Northern Lights, they controlled the horses. So we basically have to rent the horses from them because they didn't have spares. So whatever horse they gave us, one of their soldiers didn't have a horse.
Oh, my word. What was one of the greatest obstacles that you guys had to overcome?
I think the language barrier. We only had like one condo, and that was through our translator that we used to communicate with him, and just the austerity of the situation we found ourselves in. And day four, we got some water that didn't agree with us. So you can imagine what happened there. And we didn't have like spare clothes. So you managed with what you had and you just dealt with it. I mean, because the objective, we knew what the objective was. You adapt to the environment that you find yourself in, and then you march on to the objective that's been given to you, and you work through the obstacles as they come to you, because that's all you can do. Because you can't quit and take your toys and go home. You have a mission that you have to accomplish, and you just move along with the obstacles and you move on. That's all that you can do.
I love that. Can we dig into that a little bit? Because a lot of the work that I do in life coaching and working here in Hollywood with people who are either successful or trying to be successful, a lot of it has to do with obstacles. So I'd be really curious to see, how do you face obstacles? Because a lot of people will see an obstacle as an excuse and say, okay, here's my reason for turning back or not moving forward. How do you face these obstacles in order to continue moving forward? What happens in your brain?
Well, if you go back to the,
I'm going to face it.
Well, if you go back to the selection process that we go through a lot of arduous stuff, and it usually involves carrying things that are heavy and walking a long distance. And when you're doing things like that in a team, you don't want to let the team down. You don't want to be the weak link in the chain that causes you to fail, right?
Yeah.
Because you each have an equal part in that. But for individual resiliency, I think a lot of it is you just have a mindset this is just an obstacle. This may take some extra time and effort to get through it, but I will get through it. As soon as you shut yourself down, when you look at it as an obstacle, you retreat from it. You can't look at it as it's an obstacle or it's something you can't achieve. You just may not be able to conquer it in the time you thought you were. You just got to put a little bit more effort and more grit into getting it done.
I love that. I wish more people would see their life and their purpose and their objectives more in a team model, because I think that really helps people have perspective. So many people think that, well, I'm doing this for me. And because of that, it allows them to say, well, how much do I really want it or need it? But when you see in a team perspective, a community perspective, in a perspective of how many people will this affect if I quit, it really allows people to say, I've got to keep going because I can't let these people down.
Exactly.
Versus just myself. Yeah. So in the book, Horse Soldiers, what's one of your favorite sections in here, favorite stories that they captured from your experience?
All the ones I didn't know about until I read the book. because what Doug Stanton did such a great job of, he brought all these other stories in. Because when you're in your little box, you don't know what else is going on around you other than the story you're living. So when we infilled, I knew we landed and then we took off again and then landed at our final destination. But I never knew why. Yeah. But in the book, we landed in the POW camp where all the Taliban was being held. the Dawson's forces had rolled up. So we inadvertently landed there first, and the Taliban thought they were getting a helicopter ride out. I didn't know that was why we landed there, or mistakenly landed there. So I didn't know that until we read the book.
That's awesome. And about the movie, 12 Strong, what parts were really accurate? Like, you're like, oh, I'm so glad that they included this from our experience. And perhaps, if you want, what parts are just really good Hollywood fiction?
The best one that was the most accurately portrayed was when the members of ODA 595 had to go back to the village and buy their stuff back.
Yeah. You had to go back and buy your stuff?
That ash cap, because they were resupplying us. And so what they would do is they would load a C-17 up with our supplies plus humanitarian aid and a bunch of other stuff, and they just drop it. So we tried to work them, like, look, because as soon as an airplane showed up, we don't know how this happened, but as soon as we could hear the plane coming in, then all the local Afghanis heard it too, and we called them the sand people, because they showed up out of nowhere. It's like they just came up out of the sand, and next thing you know, there's 200 Afghanis, and everyone's fighting for the stuff that just got dropped out of the plane.
Oh, my word.
So on that particular drop where their stuff was borrowed, they didn't tell anybody a resupply was coming in. So that morning, like, hey, we resupplied you guys last night. Well, no one told us. We drove out to the LZ they used, and there was absolutely nothing there. It had been picked clean. They had taken the pallets, everything. And then that's when they found the stuff in the village the next day being sold.
Oh, my word. As you went from village to village, did you find other weaponry or things that had been there from either the past or the current supply?
We found one of the ODAs found an old French tank from World War I. I have a 1917 Remington bayonet from World War I. At Kuala Jangi, it was like an arms room of arms rooms. There was weapons there from World War II through the modern age. There were just rooms stacked with RPG 7 rounds. And then when we drove out to Kunduz from Mazar-e-Sharif, there was an old Soviet D-60 artillery piece that was left there during the when the Russians pulled out of Afghanistan. It was basically a road marker along the road.
Oh, my word. That's so different from, like, you wouldn't expect to go into someone's house and find a ammunition cache like that. Or
no.
Yeah, exactly. So I imagine this whole experience, 9/11, being one of the first in Afghanistan, just everything that happened at that time had to affect you deeply emotionally. How do you look at 9/11 right now, going through the experience that you did? Are there any things that you've surrounded yourself or mementos that are meaningful to you because of what you had to do and what you tried to do to help bring us back to some sense of normalcy here in the United States?
That's a great question, but I think a lot of it is, it's like looking back at our country's past and the history of the United States. We did the exact same thing our forefathers did after December 7th.
Yeah.
We volunteered. We were on the mission. We are avenging our country who was struck on our home soil, right? And that really hasn't been done. That hadn't been done for since December 7th. So that launched us on our crusade to, you know, avenge the people who were killed during 9/11. And during 9/11, I still get choked up emotionally when I see those towers fall, because I can still so vividly see that every day, you know, watching when we were sitting back here watching what was going on. I mean, just something to watch a building fall like that was just, it's indescribable for the most part, because you really can't comprehend something that big just collapsing and knowing that there's people inside that building and what they must be going through right now. Just the sheer terror of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I understand you have a piece of the World Trade Center?
Correct. Yes, I do. When we redeployed from Afghanistan after our mission was complete, the unit has its annual anniversary. And for the anniversary, later that year, upon our redeployment, we invited members of the NYPD and the New York Police Department down to visit us. So we had two firefighters and one police officer come on down, and I was actually assigned escort duty for the police officer that day. So, hey, they're staying at the hotel on post. Go get them. Like, all right. So when they came back down, they brought pieces of the World Trade Center made from one of the I-beams of the North Tower.
That's beautiful.
So they took the I-beams, they went and had it polished, and then they had it plasma etched with the Special Forces crest, which is what is on the front of that. And if you had a chance to read it, if I held it up long enough, it says, "The oppresso lead bear," which is the Green Berets' motto, is to free the oppressed. And so that's one of the things that our mission was, to free the oppressed populace of Afghanistan.
Wow, that's amazing. Now, you've gone from this, and you're actually doing some incredible stuff right now. And in the last minute and a half we have of the program, I'd love for you to share with us, what are you doing now? What are you passionate about? And how are you helping people right now?
Sure. So I work, I'm the program director for the 5th Special Forces Scholarship Fund. It's a benevolent organization that provides merit-based scholarships to the children of Special Forces and support soldiers who served within the Special Forces group. Since I started working there, we've given out over $1 million in scholarships to kids to go to college and other universities and continue their studies, sometimes even abroad. With that, I also do work for a company called Leader Solutions and Decision Support, LSDS. We do team building, leadership development, risk mitigation for travelers. And lastly, another company called Unit Solutions has hired us through LSDS to help them bring a new training system online that allows for our soldiers and our law enforcement officers to train more often at a cheaper price to make sure they're more proficient. And one of the ways the system brings a lot of training value to those people is that it can be used for active shooter training, so officers know how to respond if a terrible situation like that happens. They know what they need to do, and they can move into that school or wherever it happens much quicker and put the threat down and save the people who are trapped inside.
That's huge, and especially necessary today. Now, what's the best website for people to connect with what you're doing?
One is lsds.us. That's for Leader Solutions and Decision Support. There's also links there to go to unitsolutions.com, and that's where we have the training system that we helped develop. And the training system was actually built by, it's operator-centric, so actual operators who know how to use guns built this thing, as opposed to these guys in a box come up with something and say, "You're going to love this."
That's amazing. Well, thank you so much for your time today. And thank you for your service to our country. You've definitely helped all of us to be safer and to enjoy the liberties that we enjoy so freely here in the United States. So thank you so much, Christopher Spence, for your service. And thanks so much for joining us on the podcast. Don't forget, you can get much more content on our website, lifestyle.org, where we have broadcast, podcast, blog, and other resources for you there. So go on the journey with us to live your best life possible at lifestyle.org. Until next time, we'll see you soon.